Dr. Sanders. This gentrification issue is one that I care a lot about too, and Don and I are going to speak about it in a few minutes as well. But someone who has written a bit about this is Bob Lupton in Atlanta, and I'm sure you're familiar with him and have read his stuff. In one of his books recently, I can't remember which one, but he has a chapter called Gentrification with Justice, where he talks about the fact that, you know, gentrification is something that we need to recognize as a reality, and that it is bringing, you know, these city centers that have long been abandoned by the cultural elites and by those with power and influence are now returning to the cities. And that's something, on the one hand, that we do need to recognize the gravity of this and the fact that it's so dramatically changing and is threatening the poor. But at the same time, it's something that we want to acknowledge could be a benefit as these long abandoned city centers are rediscovered and capital and other things are pouring back into them. So what he says is, let's not throw gentrification out altogether. Let's talk about how we can harness it and use it justly. So that's his phrase, gentrification with justice. What do you think that would look like in your context? I mean, what would gentrification with justice, acknowledging its reality, but seeking to harness it in a way that is just and equitable and seeks to benefit long-term residents of the community just as much as new ones, what would that look like in your neighborhood?
That's an important question, and I think that gentrification is probably inevitable. I mean, you can rant and rave about it, but you can't stop it. I mean, I'll acknowledge that. I'm not sure. Well, I don't see eye to eye with Bob Lupton on the whole project, but let me just say I do agree that there ought to be some way to recapture or inject a justice sort of formula into it. That would include things like requiring some kind of balance of affordable housing. You know, if a developer is going to come in and do a condominium or develop a row of houses to try to make some kind of, and the city could do this. The local government could do this, say, okay, for every $300,000 condo, can you have a $75,000 condo, just to throw out some numbers, so that it can be done that way. Another thing is to just have fairness. One of the things that we're up against in Washington and in our particular situation is the notion of historic preservation, which is, again, it's a good, historic preservation is a good thing, but it can be the devil. If you're the one whose property is on the historic register and it just so much restricts what you can do. And in our case, our neighbors put our property on the historic register without our knowledge as an aggressive act against us. Okay? So that just complicates the challenge of being a good neighbor when you know not only that your neighbors have done those kinds of things, but because after all, they're gentry, so they're intelligent and they're connected and they're resourceful. But they also, what happens as I was in a conversation maybe a year and a half ago, when somebody tells you, I was sitting at dinner with a brother who told me, oh, by the way, did you know your neighbors have a legal defense fund that they have collected to use? You know, these are the same people, we're smiling and we're trying to reach out to them and, you know, trying to be a good neighbor, and they've organized themselves. So I'm not sure where the justice discourse gets you there, but the thing that I insist on is I'm not going to fight fire with fire, and if they're dirty politics, to me, it's not a solution to try to do the sort of old school, old boy kind of political strategizing, although I have people say, well, you know, you can't get anything done in Washington unless you do this, that, and the other thing. And I'm like, well, can we just have a system that's fair and square, where everybody gets treated based on not who you know, but the merits of your project or your application for a permit? So I think there are a lot of places where a consciousness of the importance of justice, and I'm so glad that he spoke about that so explicitly today, as central to the agenda, the Christian agenda, is a way that we can, as I say, my goal is to be a good neighbor. And I still, you know, see my issue though with Lupton's approach is that for me, he still leaves unanswered the question, who entitled you to relocate there in the first place? And that entitlement thing, you know, that's a race thing still.
Thank you very much for your presentation, and I really appreciated the way that you positioned Perkins in the Black evangelical tradition and also took on Smith and Emerson, the verdict that the racial reconciliation movement couldn't get off the ground within evangelicalism and how important Perkins' long and prophetic life has been. I guess my two questions are, what signs of hope do you see in the reconciliation movement, and then kind of like in the Obama era, since now one part of King's dream has been fulfilled, to have an African-American president, that there's still an unfinished agenda for building the beloved community. And it seems like what you're bringing up in terms of prophecy and prosperity and gentrification is pushing to economic justice in some sense, with this commitment to racial justice that comes out of the civil rights movement and the Black freedom movement behind that. And so as we think about building the beloved community in the Obama era, how can we be faithful to the kind of primary commitment to racial justice, given the history of slavery and segregation in this country, and yet strategically confront some of these economic issues, especially poverty and the current economic crisis and some of the housing issues that and gentrification issues that you're raising, in a way that the church is prophetic as a kind of counter political space, and yet is working together with the government in, at the policy level, which I take to be the point of the civil rights movement with the legislation, that how can we be church on Capitol Hill?
Okay, now you had about 25 questions. But let me see if I can pick and choose. I think to answer, you know, the importance of the election of Barack Obama as president signifies this to me. That, and Jeremiah said this even before the election, you know, he said that if Obama gets to be president, he's going to come after him too. And so I think that one thing we have to do is not forget where we came from. Now, I was there at the inauguration, freezing to death. But I was standing up on the bench, and I was celebrating with, I never heard a roar like that. And I've been to football games and all kinds of things. I mean, the moment he was inaugurated, I was in the number. And I had my hands raised up like anybody else. We really partied in Washington on that day. And so, you know, I was really excited. I mean, just over the top excited about his election and all that it implies. But you can't. In terms of the role, the prophetic role, prophetic ministry of Black Christians or Christians in general, we can't forget where we've come from. And here's the thing, and hear me carefully, please don't misinterpret what I'm saying or go quote me, misquote me. Barack Obama has not come from the same place where we have come from. And I say that as an African American whose ancestry includes people who were slaves. He doesn't come from there. Now, I'm not saying he's not Black, because that gets to be kind of stupid argument. But the point is, his ancestry, his distinctive ancestry, has a lot to do with his electability. Okay. Now, having said that, you stay focused on where you've come from and where we're trying to go. Where are we trying to go? We're trying to go to a place where everybody is included. Everybody has equal access to justice, regardless of what their ancestry is. Isn't that where we're trying to go? I don't have any illusion that we've gotten there just because we elected a president who has brown skin. But he represents, and part of his mystique is that he represents the American and the African without being an African American. But he's married to an African American, and then he got this mother-in-law, and then he's got these two, and so there's a black family in the White House. So it may be that the real phenomenon is Michelle and not Barack. I mean, for real, in terms of what, you know, the symbolism, okay? But we can't get distracted by the symbolism. The fact is, the economy is in the tank. There's a lot of serious issues that he is addressing. And so we just have to, when I talk about Christians, we, you know, I know that there are a lot of Christians who are popping mad that he got elected. Get over it. He's the president. And believe it or not, they actually counted the ballots and he won. So get over it and get behind the agenda that is addressing what, you know, it's like the denial, the head in the sand, you know, all of that is over. Now, one other of your many questions that I would say something about is how does the church get involved? What's the presence? What's the voice of the church on Capitol Hill? Well, I think if you ask Jim Wallace that question, nothing has changed. You know, Jim Wallace is going to have his call to renewal and all of his confrontative thing, which is as it should be. But I do think one thing that's a challenge, can I just talk to you very honestly, which I've been doing all along, but I got signed on through Barbara Skinner is Tom's widow, but Barbara Skinner, before she ever met Tom, was the director of the Congressional Black Caucus. And that means that she has always been, throughout her time in Washington, extremely well-connected and savvy political operator in Washington. It's just that when she got involved with Tom, she sort of shifted all of her energies to the evangelism and the foundation, but she still maintained some political presence with the Black Caucus. Well, thanks to Barbara, I got on the phone list and the email list for the new faith-based office. And I was on the list under the Bush administration because I had a member of my church was one of the staffers. And so, you know, I went to the conferences and I've always been a supporter of faith-based initiatives, except when it gets real funny and stupid about just giving people money to get them to vote for you. But short of that, I think there's a possibility of there being justice and some real good being done in a public-private partnership between churches and the government. But the problem is this. Now, you know, the Twitter and the Facebook and the email, a lot of what accounted for Barack Obama's success, you will recall during the Republican convention, a joke was made of him being a community organizer. And guess what? That's what helped him win the election, is that he used that savvy and that intelligence to reach voters who otherwise would have just passed on the election. So, but that continues. In fact, in some ways, they're still continuing to operate in a campaign mode. I think they're slowly transitioning out of that. But what that means is I get overwhelmed with email. I can't do a conference call every day. I can't do policy briefings every day. Now, maybe there's some pastors who have the time to do that. So I want to be involved, but I can't. It's like I'm feeling overwhelmed by white papers, even though they're electronic, but I'm just saying. You know, the white papers get to be overwhelming. And a lot of those, I mean, who has the repertoire? See, we have this kind of strange idea in the black community. I don't think the white community has this illusion, or the white church, that the black minister knows everything, been everywhere, and has this consciousness and perspective, and not, it's almost like we're God. And so, and we know what to do with every bit of information that's given to us. So I'm at a point right now where I'm just like, I'm feeling overwhelmed by the information, and I'm kind of ready to pull back from the conference calls. You know, it's not that I don't want to be involved, but it's like it's an overload. So I'm trying to feel my way. Well, how can we have the, again, my purpose in prophetic ministry is implementation. And if the White House is trying to implement some things that are going to benefit our community, benefit our nation in ways that are consistent with the ministry that we're trying to do, I'm all for that. I'm still trying to find my way as a pastor to maximize the opportunity that we now have under the new administration.
Next question. Dr. Sanders, I have been processing a whole lot, and this has been so wonderful for me. And I sense a tension between the message to, you know, to move in with the people, and at the same time to question the capacity, the entitlement, if you will. Arne Graf, who I believe is one of the founding persons with IAF, suggested to me that one of the paradigms they use in community organizing, and I understand he may have even been one who taught Barack Obama, is that you look at the world as it is, and then you look at the world as it ought to be. And what negotiates that tension is justice. Mm-hmm. And so I want to know, am I hearing correctly then that the real word for the Christian witness is discernment? And that simply means our capacity to sense entitlement from a calling and not just, you know, what we have been doing, which is trading places. Mm-hmm. You know, white folks moving out of the out of the city and into the suburbs, and then we trade places and they come back into the city and flush us out to the suburbs or whatever. But a sense of calling among ourselves where this beloved community is literally something that is being put together by the Spirit of God. What do you say?
Well, I think Dr. Perkins answered that question very eloquently this morning when he said that relocation is a calling. It's not a mandate. It's a calling. So don't do it. Don't even try it unless you specific. At least that's what I heard him say, unless you are specifically called. See, you can't argue with calling. But I think you're absolutely right. It does require discernment. But discernment doesn't always have to be an individual gift. Discernment can occur in conversation and dialogue in community, and even in community with the people who will become your new neighbors if you decide to relocate. If you're relocating with purpose, most of us pick a place to live based on the schools or the cost or, you know, the proximity to other things that we have to do. But if you're being intentional about relocating to a community with the intention to transform it, then you just have to tread very lightly. I think Jesus passed through Samaria. He didn't move in. And, you know, so he was clear. He would discern that he wasn't called to move in. But while he was there, he had his impact. Well, some of us, you know, we might have missed the calling, and we should be passing through rather than moving in. Others of us need to stay where we are. But it's a calling. So you're exactly right. The discernment is an important part of that.
I'm trying to figure out how John Perkins's life and in the three R's relate to your very different but also challenging ministry context. And also trying to think about the story of Jesus at the well. And I think I understand how he's using it in his context, but I'm trying to see if the way he's using it would translate to your context.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things that strikes me is his commitment to reconciliation. I mean, if he can be reconciled to folk who nearly beat him to death, you can be reconciled to your neighbors who have attacked you with an historic, you know, different kind of challenge. But if reconciliation applies to people that are trying to beat the crap out of you, it also applies to people who are trying to take over your neighborhood. Strikes me that way. Also, relocation. He relocated. You are being relocated. That is to say, your location is changing, but you're called to stay there. So that's a kind of relocation, right? Because the place...
Because we could leave.
You could leave, but your location is to stay in a place that's becoming different. Mm-hmm. So how do you be the gospel? How do you be Jesus in that context? Mm-hmm. The way he uses the story of Jesus at the well is that rather than approaching the woman and saying, I got water for you, he goes to her with her need. Will that translate to your situation? Now, you've said these folks are moving in. They don't want to hear the gospel. Well, that woman at the well didn't want to hear the gospel either, but Jesus built a bridge by first drawing upon her what she had that he needed. What would that mean in your context? I mean, what do those folks next door to you have that you need? And maybe the place to begin is to ask them for a drink of water or whatever that is. Does that make sense? Does that work? What would that mean?
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm not John Perkins. And so, you know, I'm like, I have bent over backwards in some cases in terms of trying to work out things with our neighbors. But I really wrestle with the extent of our, when I'm not talking about just me personally, but the extent of our flexibility as an institution, because as an African, my experience as African American is, why is it that we are the ones who always have to adjust to what white people want to do? And so I have to incorporate that question in order to respond to what you're saying, because I'm like, that's the history of my people. We always got to adjust to what white people want to do. And I'm saying, so when is it my turn to tell them, can't y'all just adjust a little bit to what we're trying to do? Or can we work together? Can we inhabit this space together? Or is it always that you're entitled and I'm the one that just had to figure out, how can I sacrifice myself so that they can be happy and we can live together?
I guess what I'm proposing is an alternative to adjusting.
All right.
Is to go into them and asking for what you want. Jesus asked the woman at the well for water because he needed it.
Are you suggesting that we haven't asked them for what we want? Okay, yes, we've asked them. And some of them have been very amenable. You know, I don't want to generalize. One of the things that happens when a conversation I've had with other, in fact, there have been other pastors in the city who've tried to enlist my support to sort of gang up on, you know, it's like a us and them thing, and that's really contradicts the ministry of reconciliation. So some of our neighbors have been very graceful and gracious, and, you know, and we've worked together, and some of them have been, you know, bad word, pain in the neck, okay? And so I don't want to generalize, but I also have to be very careful to protect the self-esteem of the people that I represent. And I'm not talking about pride or ego. I'm just saying if people have been accustomed to being run over by other people who think they're entitled, justice says to me, I'm not going to take that anymore. Now, we had some conversation about it, you know, and it's not like you throw down the gauntlet, but it's like, I'll give you an example of a situation I had just to sort of illustrate the dynamics of reconciliation. I went to a community meeting at another church, and while we were at the meeting, there was a man, he's a gay man, white man, and he just went on, when he found out that I was, it was not long after I'd become pastor at Third Street, he found out I was the pastor at Third Street, he just launched into this tirade. I mean, he got in my face, and this meeting, room full of people, your church did this, and you did that, and when Pastor Hines was there, he just went on and on and on, and I just sort of sat there and took it, okay? I'm being a Christian, right? And I ran out of cheeks to turn, okay? Well, as it turned out, the next day, I was at another meeting that was a meeting about HIV/AIDS ministry, a whole other meeting. And it was a luncheon meeting. I was sitting at a table, and then this same guy came in the door, and he came over to me and said, may I sit with you and have lunch? And I was like, oh, sure. And then the first thing that came out of his mouth, he said, I want to apologize for the way I spoke to you yesterday. But he said, but I need for you to understand the anger that we felt when such and such and such a thing happened 20 years ago, and my partner was dying of AIDS and all this stuff. So what I'm saying, because I didn't respond to him at the time I didn't match my anger with his and my tone of voice with his, we were able to come to an understanding, okay? And so that's why my point is I am flexible to a point, but we have to maintain some sense of dignity and presence and not just, you know, say, okay, you're the ones that have what we need, so just tell us what you need for us to have.
Hi, thanks very much for that amazing sort of what's a real issue for you and is a something for us to think through of a transitioning neighborhood around a church. The Emerson and Smith book, they say the problem for evangelicals, now probably be talking a bit about this tomorrow, white evangelicals, is just their inability. They seem to be programmed in such a way as to not see systemic issues of injustice. Plenty of white evangelical churches have had to face this issue in the last 20 odd years. I've studied one of them in Jackson, Mississippi. You know, white Presbyterian church, neighborhood transitions. Whites leave for the suburbs. So then the church has to decide, being faithful to the gospel, how do we serve? Do we leave? Or do we, are we somehow faithful to this community? So what does that mean? They end up doing after-school programs for local kids, that they end up appointing an African-American pastor and becoming a sort of black Presbyterian church.
And or so, multicultural?
Kind of. And so you'd sort of logically say, well, we can just apply this model to you. Your neighborhood has transitioned. If you're going to be true to people, you have to find out what the needs of the people with dogs and blogs are and serve those people. But, of course, the piece that's missing is the issue of power, right, which makes it completely different. Mm-hmm. And so this goes back to your first point of sort of the prophetic ministry. And it seems like the sort of the power of John Perkins's message is really preaching the Beatitudes, right? Taking his passion for the poor and the powerless to the people with money, as he says, laying his passion on them so they'll relocate their cash to what he's doing. But it seems to me that perhaps the Sermon on the Plain in Luke's gospel is the kind of prophecy. I mean, you know, woe to the rich. And that, I'd like to, is that a gospel that you would, how do you preach that perhaps to?
Well, I don't think I preach to them by giving them a bagel and a cup of coffee and telling them to come in and sit down. But I will say this, I continue to look for different ways to communicate. Like, for instance, I said already, we have a white, it's not lily white, but, you know, basically the gentrified neighborhood association. We have worked very hard to build relationships with them on their own turf. We come to the meeting because we're in the neighborhood, and we share information. When we had a community day year before last, we had a dog show. You know, because they all of them got dogs. So we said, well, let's have a dog contest. So the dog that was most obedient, the prettiest dog, the ugliest dog, you know, we gave out prizes. And it was an amazing thing. The dogs all got along. You know, the big dogs, the dogs had the best time, really. And the dogs, people brought their dogs, and the dogs had so much fun. And I was like, oh, this is a good thing. So we have fun with the dogs. So when I say dogs and blogs, I'm not just joking. I mean, that's their life. Those things are important to them. And so it's like, okay, well, if that's important to you, then let's try to incorporate that into, you know, because that's not something, you know, we don't bring our dogs to church. But some of our members brought their dogs to be in the contest. And we had a lot of fun with that. So we try to find places for conversation and establish rapport, but to have them in a space where we can preach the gospel, that's what I'm trying to figure out to do, because they don't relate to the way we worship or the message that we preach. And when I have some of them who will come to the church, I have a few of the neighbors, they'll come, but they sort of stay at the margin. They don't really come in and get too deeply involved with what we're doing. But we try really hard to at least, I think every church, regardless of whether it's urban, rural, black, white, whatever, every church ought to have an open door. And so that anybody who comes there, even if they don't understand your worship or your language, that they don't feel when they walk to the door that, you made a mistake. You didn't mean to come here. You meant to go to the church around the corner. And so we try to maintain an open door, but that's not enough.
I guess what I'd like to hear your reflection on is, so for this white church where the neighborhood transitions, they realized through a rather painful process they were going to have to change it. If they were going to reach the new local people, they were going to have to change their worship. And not only that, they were advised, no one is going to believe you've really changed until you change the person in the pulpit. Now, in your situation, I mean, that's white hegemony, right? It would be, you know, if you want us to come, you're going to have to change everything you do. That becomes a very different, I mean, power completely changes what's going on there. So is part of the gospel witness for you to not change in a changing neighborhood?
I think so.
This will have to be the last question. Thank you.
Does someone
else want to come out? You got it. Oh, I thought
I was thinking that, I mean, the hardest thing that you said was, and I'm assuming you were being facetious, mm-hmm. when you said, how do we adapt to their sensibilities? Mm-hmm. That was facetious. Oh, good.
Wait a minute. Adapted? No, I was very serious. Sensibilities, yes. I meant that. Okay. Because the way we worship, the way we do refreshments, the way we dress, it's not, they don't identify with that. So it's like, oh, no, I wouldn't go to that church. Because they don't serve, what's the name of that coffee you have? Fair trade coffee. They serve tasters. Oh, no, we wouldn't go to that. So I'm very serious about
it. I see what you're talking. I was thinking you were talking more about how you speak about the gospel. But
they don't necessarily relate to the way I preach either.
That it's the, you said there's some graceful people.
Yes.
It seems to me that it's the responsibility then of the white people who do want to connect with you, of the white Christians that you have located in that group, to do the work with their white or wealthy neighbors to talk about the, like, the city policy. If you are building our condo, mm-hmm. then build housing so other people can stay. It seems like that's, would there be just any chance? If I were there.
Okay.
I don't know if I could do this, but what I would hope would be that you would engage with me and that I could engage with you in a way so that I could be responsible enough to my neighbor and to Christ to go to my neighbors and say, look, here we are, so this is our responsibility together to have a neighborhood that we can all live in, I hope.
Well, let me...
Let me
respond by just giving you an example real quick. We have a neighbor who owns a property that adjoins a property that we own, and we've had over the years to work out some issues with expansion. They are Quakers. I mean, they have their own, you know, we're not trying to evangelize them. I mean, they are Quakers. I mean, and so they not only understand, they endorse what we're about and the kind of things that we're doing in the community. They're not going to join our church. But we are able, well, you belong to Society of Friends? Yeah. You would say, okay. So you know sense of the meeting and all that? Well, see, I know all about that. So when I sit at the table with them, it's all about sense of the meeting. I mean, if we have differences, we keep talking till we get it settled. But the next neighbor, I don't know what church he belongs to, but we figured out, they told us, said, well, you know, he doesn't get along with us either. You know, it's not, you know, we can say, oh, well, that white neighbor who doesn't, you know, and what I'm saying, even among the white neighbors, some of them are unchurched, some of them have their own commitments. I don't treat them as a whole. I'm trying real hard, even, and I think I'm probably being misunderstood. I'm not trying to paint with one brush. This is how those neighbors are.
That at all?
But I recognize that some of our neighbors are going to embrace and even volunteer and support and assist us in what we're doing. But that's the extent of it. It's not the same as preaching the gospel. They don't necessarily, they don't want to be saved. But they do endorse our collective project of community transformation. And that's good enough for me. It's just that there are others of them who are unchurched, who when they come to visit, they kind of, you know, they sit on the back row and they're like, I'm not sure, you know, I'll drop in when I can. But they don't identify with us. And the only way I know to make them feel comfortable is to just do what I would call an extreme makeover, and that might be more than I can accomplish.
Dr. Sanders, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anytime I can twist your arm to come back, you're welcome.
Okay.
It's wonderful seeing you again.
Thank you.
And wonderful to meet your students, and of course, have your students now as my students.
Yes.